Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast. My name's Jack Collins. I'm joined by the one and only Mr. Dean Jones, and it is time for us to preview the Premier League. Here we go again. DJ, how you doing?
I'm good, mate. Yeah, I'm excited to get this going again, see what Arsenal can do. We're judging them differently this season, so we've always gone into a season, even if they look good, say, well, they're going to bottle it, aren't they? No, they're the champions. They don't bottle things anymore. They've just smashed Man City in the Community Shield. We're judging Arsenal differently this season, and we've got to give them a new level of respect, I think.
I think very much so. And that level of respect will extend to the fact we will start with Arsenal today, the reigning champions. And look, I don't know how you see it, Dean, but I think that the business this summer has been very sensible, well put together. The move for Bruno Guimaraes obviously took up a lot of the headlines, but that midfield looks absolutely stacked. Now, seven players in there for three positions. And you look at it going Declan Rice, Bruno Guimaraes, Mikel Merino, Zubimendi, Miles with Skelly, Eze, and you're kind of sticking at it and going, well, Havertz can drop into those areas as well. There's so much to look at in terms of what they've got going on here. And then Martin Ødegaard, who looked fresh as an absolute daisy again and had his best performance in an Arsenal shirt in quite some time in that Community Shield, where he looked right back at it and has done really since the World Cup. I mean, I'll start with the kind of big hot take here. I don't necessarily just see Arsenal winning the league again this season, but I think there is a really good chance that Arsenal are sort of 10, 11 points clear by the time we get to Christmas.
Well, they've got an advantage over everybody else, basically, in the fact that they have momentum and they're also very settled. So they've got something which all the others are struggling for. You know, Arsenal are the favourites to win the Premier League. And if you look to the next two clubs, you're looking at Man City and Liverpool. Both have had upheaval. Both have new managers. Both clubs need to get to grips with a new era. Arsenal have built something over 6 years. Arteta is now the longest serving manager in the Premier League.
And the only manager to have won the Premier League in the Premier League, which is kind of wild.
And this is it. We've moved on. You know, a Premier League now without a Guardiola, without a Jurgen Klopp, without a Jose Mourinho, without a Ferguson. These are managers that have, you know, Wenger, I didn't even say him, but that, you know, they've had these eras of dominance. They've had these eras, even if Klopp wasn't dominant, you know, he was involved in huge moments in Premier League history, fractious moments, big rivalries. And you know, it's weird that the rivalries are going to be different this time around. I mean, you've got in Arteta, obviously someone that is bullish, someone that is stubborn, somebody that certainly is intense. And obviously Maresca is like that too and is fiery. But outside of that, mate, you've got like Xabi Alonso and Iraola as two of his main rivals this season. And they're all kind of Basque friends. Like, I can't see these two
are getting the same team growing up.
Yeah, these are actual mates. Like, this isn't like the old times when we heard people going at each other. There's more chance that these three are trying to figure out how to have a glass of red wine together after a game than throwing jibes at one another to make back pages. So that's different. But Arsenal, it's really interesting the way that Arteta himself is approaching this season. He's been asked, you know, how do you feel about defending a title? And he said, we're not. We're attacking another title. And that's really interesting way to frame it. And obviously, he's a little bit David Brent in the way that he talks about things and the way that he speaks to his players and stuff. But little things like that, they do make a difference to how you approach things, to the way that you think about things. Because this isn't about Arsenal defending a title. Obviously, defending a title doesn't literally mean sitting on the edge of your box, just kicking the ball away because you don't want someone to take away your trophy. But I like the fact that Arteta's coming in here being like, nah, we ain't defending. We've signed players and we're going to sign more players. That mean we're going at this front-footed. We are not just going to win the title again this season. We're going to batter you all, and we're going to make sure that you know that Arsenal are becoming a dominant force in this league. We're not just here to be satisfied with our 1 year of Premier League glory.
In terms of the way that Arsenal go about this, I thought they were absolutely excellent in that win over City. Now, obviously, this is a new City under Maresca, and you know, we're kind of looking at it from slightly different angles in that they're probably not quite cooked enough for the City, you know, for the season yet, and it will improve, and there'll be plenty more signings. The reason we don't necessarily predict the league in these preview shows is because we'll do that in 5x5 when we get to the end of the window and we've got a couple of games under our belt to really understand where everyone is and make kind of more storied or at least more kind of sensible predictions based on the evidence we have in front of us. But I think there is a lot of discussion around the kind of way that Arsenal are going to play this season. Now, look, you know, and we've had this discussion and argument over the last sort of year or so, that I think that there are serious caveats and very reasonable ones around some of the way that Arsenal played in the back end of last season. Bukayo Saka looked like he was playing on one leg. Martin Odegaard completely off the boil and missing large parts of the season. Same for Kai Havertz. It felt like kind of just claw your way over the line and make sure that the job gets done. That monkey is off their back now in some regards. And also, it looks like Saka is able to turn both ways again. It looks like Martin Odegaard is in a place where he'll be able to dominate and dictate games and take it to opposition players. Are we expecting Arsenal to play slightly differently this year, especially with the rule changes regarding corners and giving fouls, etc., before the whistle has been blown? And especially now that they do actually have, for the first time in a little while, and with all due respect to Leandro Trossard, who's a wonderful footballer in his own right, but a bit of a scruffy footballer, a bit of a finisher, incredibly clutch, but not necessarily a creative star. Christos Solis, who, you know, may be the starting player for this season, they might look to upgrade that area anyway, but they have a creative threat on that left-hand side. And suddenly it's like, oh, Arsenal can attack you down both flanks. Arsenal can create things from both sides of the pitch. I'm excited to see what they can do with him and Bruno Guimaraes kind of being a more creative presence in the middle of midfield rather than the legs we saw last year. If this is an Arsenal side that actually goes out to attack the season in a way that might appeal to more neutrals, should we say?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they weren't the most entertaining title winners we've ever seen, but you know, they certainly had their big moments throughout the season. Trossard's impact, perhaps underrated, to be honest with you. But Arteta's gone away from last season. He's absolutely indulged in the celebrations afterwards and made sure that he has made the most of the success that he's deserved. But at the same time, he's got a fear that doesn't happen again. And I think that's just driving him on. And I think that, like, he's such a calculated figure. He would have been away on holiday, at home, in coffee shops, just calculating, like, what are my potential flaws? Like, how can we get better? And Bruno Guimaraes, like, huge upgrade to the squad. Like, that's just an unbelievable player to bring in for depth to the squad. May well end up being a regular starter. Maybe that he plays specific games ahead of somebody else. Like, we'll have to wait to see how Arteta balances it. And then Solis, somebody that they'd had their eyes on for a while. Few teams had, to be honest with you, Tottenham particularly. But we've already seen the sort of impact that he could make and the qualities that he's got. They do not sign players for the sake of it, Arsenal. You have to be of a certain caliber now. It's part of the reason that we haven't yet seen them sign a centre-back or another forward, because there's such a small basket of players that they can now go shopping for. Like, there's not many players that are better than what they've got. And Arteta's very, very careful about pulling the trigger. So, yeah, they will be better than they were last season, and they'll be extremely hard to beat, and that's why they're champions.
Yes, and I think that they look like a good bet to potentially hold on to that trophy as well. I mean, you know, before the season began, I think a lot of people were looking at Manchester City as potentially their closest challengers. We've seen City and Arsenal kind of going at it neck and neck at times in over the last couple of seasons, with all due respect to Liverpool for the way that they went about their business 2 years ago. But it has been, you know, this conversation. And we're looking at it here, Dean, at a Manchester City side that isn't quite in turmoil. And I think it's a stretch to suggest that there isn't still an unbelievably talented squad here, but one which has undergone a pretty seismic change. Not only have they lost Pep Guardiola, probably the greatest manager maybe of all time, but at the very least of his era, but and replaced him with Enzo Maresca, who has far more to prove in the managerial game than Pep did when he came into this Manchester City side, but also Rodri and Bernardo Silva and John Stones. And that's a lot of the leadership group at Manchester City as well. And I thought they looked a little bit rudderless at the weekend against Arsenal. I'm not going to read, you know, everything into a Community Shield game that is sometimes treated a little bit like a preseason friendly, but it was a little bit noticeable, I thought, that City looked like there wasn't people necessarily holding others to the same standards that we've come to expect from this team.
Yeah, I mean, look, in terms of the players that they're losing, I don't think it's as bad in that personnel front as it looks. They've lost Rodri, Stones, they'll lose Savinho, they'll lose Reinders, right? They'll lose, these are all big personalities, big players, obviously Bernardo as well. But when you actually calculate the input of those players over the course of last season, they were all missing for large sections of it through either choice from Guardiola or injury or whatever else. So that part I'm not concerned about. What I would be concerned about was that Guardiola had the ability to lift the capabilities of everybody. And even when they seemed to be struggling, he could find another level in them. And if he couldn't, then his assistants could. You know, they could get into them. They understood the characteristics, the personalities, the traits of the team. So even, you know, like sell Trafford for £40 million or whatever, that's fine. That doesn't affect you. Like Reinders getting £50-odd million in for him, it's good. Like they're even going to look into selling Nico Gonzalez, who you thought might have a future now, but nope, they're going to move him on. Wasn't a big impact player. Like, but obviously you're like, well, who is a big impact player then? And it has to be that Elliot Anderson becomes a big impact player. It has to be that Haaland has an unbelievable season. It has to be that Doku signs a new contract and now has an unbelievable season. We need to see the old Phil Foden. So there are things that have to happen for Man City. And it was a concern, like the Community Shield performance and result was a concern, because to get beaten so convincingly just affects the, I guess, perhaps your fan base more than even the team, because you just want to know from the outset that you've got a chance. Man City finished, what, 7 points behind Arsenal last season. And right now, what we're remembering about Man City is the gap between them and Arsenal at the end of last season. The fact Arsenal just beat them 3-0. We're forgetting the 8 Premier League titles that came before this. We're forgetting the era of dominance that Pep Guardiola built, because it kind of doesn't matter. All that matters is next week and the week after that now. So while it's great to build these things and to have dominant eras in football, it's only relevant for a short period of time. And then it's all about, but what now? What next? And what next is Elliot Anderson good enough to fill that gap? Do they sign Enzo Fernandez? Are they also going to go to Chelsea and try and get Pedro Neto and Malo Gusto out of there so that Enzo Maresca's got some players that he knows are identifiable with his system? These are all problems that Man City have now got to overcome in the space of 2 weeks in the transfer window and a few days in terms of getting their season up and running. It's fascinating. And I'm not by any stretch suggesting that Man City are going to like struggle this season, but it's not very convincing from what we're looking at right now.
I think what's interesting is, you know, how this configuration works itself out, because they looked absolutely overwhelmed in midfield. And, you know, at right back, the options at right back, neither of them are natural right backs, right? Matheus Nunes is obviously in that situation and he's been converted, but will he suit what Enzo Maresca wants to do? Where, you know, at Chelsea, we saw Malo Gusto at right back playing as a 10 some of the time. And then you have Kucinov, who I think is just much better suited in the middle. Is Ruben Dias going to be the guy that he looks to in there to begin attacks and make things happen. All of those things I think are really interesting. And do they have enough depth in those wide areas? Because yes, Doku had an excellent end to last season and Semenyo had a fantastic campaign. Semenyo looked wildly off the boil in terms of this game. Maybe that works itself out. But if Savinho goes, and yes, you're talking about lack of impact last season, but Jack Grealish got on the pitch here. He was out of the club last season and looked permanently on his way out when he went to Everton on loan. I just look at it and it doesn't feel like a particularly complete squad. And yes, they will do business over the next couple of weeks. And yes, they will, I'm sure, plug some of these gaps. And there are signs of life, right? Like there was a couple of beautiful crosses from Elliot Anderson. There was a couple of great little knocks through the lines. And once him and Haaland are on the same wavelength, I have no doubt whatsoever that that will be a really good source of goals for this City side. And if you have the best striker in the league, who all of us feel is probably going to repeat as the Golden Boot winner, you know, you're looking at it and saying, well, what's the floor, right? What's the lowest you can get to if you have a striker that scores 25, 30 goals? It's pretty good, right? The floor for that is pretty good. And I still think City will be absolutely fine in terms of, I think they'll qualify for the Champions League, etc. But I just don't know what the drop-off is going to be from Guardiola to Maresca in terms of getting these players to understand the same kind of systems and squeezing that extra bit of juice out of them in the same kind of way. And I just wonder if we're going to see a City side that maybe fall away a little bit from the title race at this point. And look, that's kind of fine, right? You can have a transition season. You're coming away from, you know, as you say, the greatest manager in the club's history and someone who has defined English football for the best part of a decade. But it's also a weird thing when City have been so dominant from a trophies perspective, 20 trophies in 10 years, that they might end up having a season where actually there's not really any silverware on the table. And that feels like a bit of a missed opportunity in many different ways.
Yeah, I mean, look, they'll begin their campaign at home to Bournemouth and then we'll see some answers within that game. It's a difficult match because it's one they are expected to win. Bournemouth obviously in a bit of a transitional period themselves, but perhaps have more trust in Bournemouth to go there and kind of just set up in a way that just gets them through the first game. Man City are kind of going to be expected to take the game to them in a way that sets the tone for a season. But at the same time, they can't afford to go and lose on the opening day. Then going into the second game against Crystal Palace on a Friday night, you'll be starting to be fearful. Maresca is obviously quite an emotional character, can display those emotions sometimes in a negative way. Obviously, Pep was emotional, but in periods when he needed to be calm, he tended to be. And, you know, we've seen with Maresca that he can throw his toys out the pram, and whether he aims that at his players or the board remains to be seen depending on which club he's at. But he's landed himself an unbelievable opportunity here. He's got one of the biggest jobs in football. It's one that he craved. It's a club he does know. And so for now, I'm willing to kind of give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that the cobwebs are blown off in these early weeks while he gets to grips with it.
Yeah, well, I think he'll hope so, because a bad start after, you know, what Guardiola achieved is something that I wonder what it looks like to the City fan base, who, to be fair, I think will be relatively patient, especially the old guard who were there through the darker days of City's history. But maybe the new generation who are used to City winning things on a regular basis might not accept a season of mediocrity, should we say, in inverted commas. Let's flip over to the other side of Manchester and go to Manchester United, who are back in the Champions League, and I assume we'll be hoping to go further than the first game of each cup competition this time out. Michael Carrick is now the second longest serving manager of the Big Six, which is incredibly funny considering he's been in the job for 7 months. But
he hasn't even, he's only just got the job. He's just got it at the end of the season.
No, we'll give him the interim period. We'll give him the interim period. But I mean, look, United had an excellent second half of the campaign. Carrick did a lot to, you know, dispel any of the concerns about him. But this is now a difficult job in terms of going back to playing midweek football, dealing with rotations in the squad. It was very much a Man United side under Carrick that felt very settled and didn't change very much. He's not going to have that same kind of luxury. They've obviously bought a couple of key players in the window, Tielemans and Andre Santos, early doors, feeling like really good bits of business, I think, from where I'm standing. I like both those players. a lot. They're going to have to fill the gap from Casemiro. It feels like they probably still need an extra midfielder in there, but you'd imagine that would be done towards the end of the window. They still look a little bit light at left back, and they did get a bit eviscerated by Milan at the weekend. But when you come up against a coach of the caliber of Ruben Amorim, you know, these things can happen. But I'm just not quite sure where I have United right now. I think a successful season would be finishing the top four, you know, get to the quarter semi-final of the cup and, you know, make sure they're, you know, through the first couple of rounds of the knockout stages of the Champions League. I think that would be seen as consolidation success after so many years sort of wandering around in, let's say, the wilderness, inverted commas.
Yeah, I just don't think they can balance all this, Jack. I think that it's come too soon to expect them to be able to balance out all these competitions. They don't have the squad depth for me. I mean, I like United. I like probably 15 of what they've got. And once you're beyond that, I just think that they're falling short. And what worries me about that is that you're two injuries away from big problems. I thought that they would support more actively than they have in this transfer window. Like the noises were great. The initial movements were good for United in the transfer market. I mean, they signed, we thought, Ederson from Atalanta before the transfer window was even opened, and they haven't even signed him. And when they didn't sign him, they moved on. They did sign two good midfielders, but have they signed one that genuinely takes them on to another level? They were linked with Elliot Anderson. They were linked with Tchouameni. They were linked with Adam Wharton. They haven't signed anyone on that level. Andre Santos, good. Yuri Tielemans, very good. But I don't think these are players that you're expecting to lead you into like a new level towards where you're starting to think about challenging for a title, which is...
Yeah, I'd agree. Santos maybe in a year or two. I really like what the potential that he has, but there's plenty of growth still to happen there. We haven't seen him have all that many minutes. And I really like Tielemans, and I think that he will work well as kind of a secondary midfielder. I think he'll work really nicely with Bruno Fernandes, but there still doesn't look like maybe the physical muscle in that midfield right now to really kind of lock in on them and think that they're going to be able to challenge for silverware, really.
Exactly, even silverware. Like the title's obviously, like, you know, Man United fans expecting to win the league this season, right? But you want to win a trophy and you want to be competitive in every competition. Like that is what you would probably expect at this stage of evolution, considering there was that thing that they were going to win the Premier League. What was it, by 2028, was it originally?
Yeah, that deadline's starting to come around. But again,
that's like coming around, and that ain't going to happen.
Movement towards that as a goal. Like if they were to finish second this season and I say win, you know, one of the cups, that would be a major improvement. I think that would be a very, very successful season.
Yeah, I think second should be an aim, to be honest, mate. I know it sounds weird to aim for second, but like they're miles off of Arsenal as it stands. To be honest, they're still quite far adrift of Man City, but because of the upheaval at Man City, they might be scoped there to make up some ground. But United have got, like, they've been looking at a left back. They haven't signed one. So if Luke Shaw gets injured, then they're in big trouble. And obviously there's a pretty high chance of that. They decided not to sign a left winger, and then Marcus Rashford ended up staying anyway. So they've kind of solved that, but they're solving it with a player that they'd kind of wipe their hands off, now are trying to play up. It feels like a new signing. I hope it is. I hope Rashford's great. I genuinely do. We don't know. We don't know what we'll get from him. So far, his attitude looks good. His application seems good. His energy seems positive. So I hope that works out for them. Still feel they might be short of another centre forward, something else that they've considered looking at and haven't done. So, yeah, it's promising, but I just feel like they're going to be a little bit short as we sit here today. One thing I will say is I don't believe for a second that Man United will be finished in the transfer window. They're certainly not a club that's threatening to get near that £100 million mark, which every other club is willing to go shopping in at their level at the moment. But there's too much to be done here for them to ignore it. So once we get to September 2nd, a couple of weeks into the season, plus seeing maybe a couple of additions to this squad, I think it'll be a fairer time to assess what we can expect from them.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll put pin in United there. Let's flip quickly over to Liverpool, because talking of chaos and fans being frustrated with a lack of signings, they feel like maybe the standard bearers for where that's at. There is question marks over who is going to replace Mo Salah. There have been question marks over the defence, although they have done something to address that issue with signing of Ronald Araujo. But he is also incredibly injury prone, and that does worry me a little bit as well. They look light in midfield. They look light in attack. They look a little bit light at fullback. It just doesn't feel like a summer that's brimming with confidence from a Liverpool perspective, even if I'm a huge, huge fan of Andoni Iraola.
Yeah. I think with Iraola, you sense that you're getting here somebody more enthusiastic than Arne Slot, somebody more fun than Arne Slot, and somebody braver, probably. I think that the early signs are really promising in that the relations that he's looking to build. I think Arne Slot didn't do a good enough job of bonding himself with the Liverpool fan base and the Liverpool media. Obviously, at first it was fine because they won the league. But what happened after that, it just felt like there was always a little bit of distance between the two. And Iraola has gone away from that straight away. He's trying to embrace the club. He's doing sit-down interviews with fan channels, and he's trying to make it a very intrinsic feeling. It's like, we're in this together. Like, I'm new here. I don't know anywhere near about as much about this club as you guys do, but I'm leading it, so let's get on with this together. And I think in that sense, mate, he'll bring some of the fun back. I think one thing you saw about Bournemouth is that they weren't afraid to have a go. They weren't afraid to express themselves. And I think Liverpool were afraid to express themselves under Arne Slot last season, and that was one of their big flaws. And hand in hand with that comes that you get a better version of Florian Wirtz. You get a more confident version of Alex Isak. Maybe you get Bradley Barcola come in and light the place up. So I think from that sense, Liverpool can be optimistic. I don't think overnight they're going to be sensational. I think that they might have a couple of difficult results, to be honest, in the first month, maybe even 2 months. But over the course of the season, I think there can be a confidence that you've got a coach here that has a good enough understanding now of the Premier League. He's got to get to grips with this level of the Premier League, because that's different. And we've seen other managers struggle when they make that step up. I think he'll be better than like a Graham Potter to Chelsea situation. I'm not saying I don't think he can succeed here, but I do think it's difficult because it's a different level of expectation. But obviously the club are supporting him. He identified that he was worried defensively, even with Xhaka, who looks really good. They went out, got him Ronald Araujo, bring him in, starting to settle. Calms the nerves a little bit, gives you a little bit of ease about that situation. I think it'll be okay. I don't know if they can push for a title, but I think it'll be okay.
Yeah, I think he'll be okay as well. I think the Liverpool fans will really like Iraola's football, right? Like, I think that there will be a new air of excitement around Anfield, and that's a really powerful thing to build, as you say. You know, getting those relationships right and making sure everyone's on the same page is a really important thing at Liverpool, perhaps more so than elsewhere in some regards, because of what Anfield can give you in these situations. But I do think that right now, with how light the squad looks and how Iraola wants to play, how he wants to press, how he wants to be on the front foot, like, that's a dangerous game to be playing with a really, really thin squad, because injuries can seriously derail you. And they're going from a relatively passive system under Arne Slot to a manager who demands an extraordinary level of intensity from his players. And whilst I think that every signing that Liverpool have made thus far looks like a good one, as you say, Xhaka looks excellent. I'm really excited about Victor Munoz, who I think has come in to play a major role here. I don't think that Liverpool have brought him in to effectively be, you know, a part-timer. I think they see something in him and his intensity that should add up to what they want to do as a football club under Iraola. I'm just really concerned about the lack of depth. And yes, he's been known to trust youngsters. And yes, I think a few of the academy products will get more minutes under Iraola than they did under Arne Slot. I'm just still a little bit wary that this squad looks very, very light right now. And a couple of key injuries, like if Alexander Isak was to get injured, and I know you can point to almost anyone and be like, well, if Erling Haaland gets injured, City would be in trouble. Like, sure. But with Ekotike injured at the moment and out for a significant portion of this season, you're putting a lot of faith in Alexander Isak to effectively hit the ground running and play a lot of minutes. And considering his travails last season, I'd just be a little bit concerned of him, especially within, you know, what this manager wants to do and the way that he wants to attack the game.
Yeah, we'll see. But I think that just watching pre-season, you just really need to unlock something special. He's got to find a way to get Wirtz into holes and Isak getting around in between to find those little channels, those little pockets ahead of Wirtz, maybe even beside Wirtz. Sticking away those, you know, the way he used to steer the ball home, right? You can all picture it in your head, the way that Isak steers a ball into that far corner. Let's get back to finding that. There's been signs of it in pre-season.
A little bit Henry-esque, right?
Yeah, it is. It's just such a great habit that he's had that he's unfortunately got out of, partly confidence, partly injury, but he'll pick it back up in no time if they can get off to a good start.
Okie dokie. All right. Well, we're going to take a break then. We come back on the other side. I'm going to talk a bit about Chelsea and Tottenham and Aston Villa, as well as covering the rest of the clubs in the Premier League in part three. So make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC and part two of our big Premier League preview. It's Jack Collins and Dean Jones alongside you. And I think, Dean, there is a level of intrigue around Chelsea that we haven't seen in a little while. They might be the most interesting club in the Premier League at this point, with all of the changes that have happened here, with the shift in transfer policy in terms of signing Danny Welbeck and Jordan Henderson, in terms of whether Xabi Alonso can bounce back from that incredibly difficult time at Real Madrid. It all just feels completely and utterly sort of who knows what we're going to get from Chelsea. Signs in preseason have been really good. The fact that their potential front three of João Pedro, Morgan Rodgers and Cole Palmer looks like a whole heap of fun. There's the Enzo Fernandez question that obviously is still hanging over some of this, but the three at the back seems to have addressed some of the defensive concerns from last year. They'll have Levi Colwill back, Maxence Lacroix, who's been a mainstay of a three at the back for Crystal Palace. They've brought in two new wing backs who look like they're going to get up and down the flanks and really kind of dominate in that kind of way. I think the early signs for Chelsea are really, really good. I'm quite positive about where they are going into this season, but I think they remain the great unknown in some regards, because we know how quickly things can go crashing down at Stamford Bridge as well.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Obviously, we're called Ranks FC. We look at the teams, we give ourselves an idea of where we expect everybody to land, and in that first section, you know, people won't argue that those will be four teams we expect to be in or competing for the top four. And obviously, in the second section, Chelsea are another team that you will have in that conversation. They finished 10th last season, Jack. Like, 10th place Chelsea. Like,
I have no doubt it won't be as bad as that again.
It won't be as bad as that. In fact, they will be back in the top six. And I actually think we're heading back towards the traditional top six here. I think we are looking at Arsenal, City, Liverpool, United, Chelsea and Tottenham back in that top six. It'll be bye-bye Villa, bye-bye Bournemouth, bye-bye Sunderland, Brighton. You can all forget it. We're getting back to where we came from now, judging by what we've seen from these teams in this transfer window. They're
for
all
what
scared.
It's worth, I feel slightly differently about Villa than you do, but we'll get to that.
These teams are having to make big, big decisions to make sure that they're not missing out on that again. And I think Chelsea perhaps have gone above and beyond by changing managers again, getting Xabi Alonso in, going for a change of style, a change of how they run the club, how they buy players. Everything's kind of gone out the window here. Alonso is quite a likable character, I think by most people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And my fear is, to be honest, that he builds quite a likable Chelsea, mate. Like, that's part of my fear. Like, I like Morgan Rodgers. I'm an England fan. I've liked what he's done at Aston Villa. I want to see him continue to get better. I see him coming to a front line of João Pedro, I think, is going to have a great season. I think we'll see the rejuvenation of Cole Palmer. A little bit worried that I might start to like Chelsea at this rate. They're going to play some really smooth football, right? They're going to be really nice to watch. They're going to be easy on the eye. And their fans are going to enjoy going to Stamford Bridge again. That's what I mainly predict. Like, they weren't enjoying going to Chelsea anymore for much of the last few years. There was no identity. They weren't able to relate to their players anymore. And a lot of Chelsea fans out there are actually hoping they do sell Enzo Fernandez because they didn't really like what he did for Argentina. And even before that, there were fans that weren't completely obsessed with Enzo Fernandez.
And if they what truly happened in the Champions League, right? When he came out and spoke to the press and was like, I'd love to live in Madrid. You're like, mate, can you leave it out, please?
It's not great, is it? Yeah. So if they could get anything close to £120 million for him, there'll be parties in West London over it. We'll see how this experience thing measures up. Xavi Alonso was concerned when he came in. He looks over his squad and his big thing was like, this team struggles in moments of adversity. They don't have any leaders. They don't know what to do when things stack up against them. We've got to redress that. And in Welbeck and Henderson, that's two players that he's brought in to just kind of change the vibe of that team. He's got two players that he can bring in to manage moments of games in different ways. We're seeing football completely differently to at any point when we've seen it ever, to be honest. And we have so many substitutions. We have so many breaks. We have sometimes like four mini games within a game now with terms of tactical plans, in terms of who's on the pitch. You talk about finishers. You're like, this is my starting lineup, but how am I finishing this game? And it's as important now. And that's what Xavi Alonso is starting to bring in here now. He's got Danny Welbeck and Jordan Henderson, who, no, they're not going to be in the starting lineup every week, but that doesn't matter anymore. What matters is when you get to the 65th minute and you're starting to see players starting to fatigue, you're starting to see someone's got a knock or somebody's got a jolt in their confidence or they've missed a chance or they've missed a tackle. And you've got players like this that can come in and just calm things down or eat up a big chance or take a big penalty. That's what he's tried to do. So I think that that's interesting. And I think that that's a big boost for Chelsea. They've also brought in Aston Villa's set piece coach, which is big. You know, this is another big area of trying to get an edge, you know? Trying to get an edge. We talk about moments within games. This all matters. We've seen from Mikel Arteta that it can take a while, but over the course of his reign, he's made adjustments in personnel. He's made adjustments to the way that they play, adjustments to the way that they take corners and throw-ins. And all of it eventually led to them becoming champions again. Now, Chelsea probably won't go 22 years without a title, but it's starting to feel like it because they were a million miles away last season. But under Alonso, I think that with the style of play, with the kind of backroom that he's building, with the experience that he's adding, it's starting to look good. Obviously, like, they have got to sort out this Enzo thing. I know they set a deadline last week on him leaving. Like, you can't just make up your own transfer deadlines. Not how it works. He could still leave Chelsea, could still end up at Man City under terms that Man City are perfectly happy with. So I think that's pretty likely. It'll be very interesting to see what they would do in terms of replacing him. You know, is it an Alex Scott, an Adam Wharton? Is it like a Lamin Kamara type figure? Is it someone a bit different, you know? But again, another Basque manager. There's plenty of them. 20% of the Premier League has Basque management right now. Mm-hmm. Crazy.
A hotbed of managerial brilliance, I think.
Brilliance, exactly.
Where we're
that.
At right now. Look, I just think that this squad is starting to look quite good. And that doesn't mean that everything is perfect. And I'm sure there are plenty of Chelsea fans screaming at it, going, oh, you know, there's a couple of players missing. And I think that's true. But equally, I think that Chelsea now need to offload before they kind of make those finishing touches to this squad, which I expect them to do. And look, there's plenty of players not getting minutes at the moment. But when you look at where they're at in terms of, you know, the squad that started at the weekend against Real Sociedad. I watched them a couple of times in preseason, watched them kind of eviscerate Milan, which they looked really, really good in. And I'm kind of looking at it now going, okay, you know, Lacroix feels like a very good fit in terms of sitting in the middle of that back line. If Levi Colwill is back and at full fitness again, that's a massive boost to them. And was one of the, you know, the reasons that I think they struggled building out of the back last season. It looks like Reece James is going to be utilized as a midfielder. I don't necessarily think he fits in that wing back system. And yes, he could probably play right centre back, but if they're going to utilize him in midfield, I think that Xabi Alonso will love Moises Caicedo. The three in the front look really kind of fun and changeable. And then, you know, you're bringing players off the bench, like an Estevao, who's going to get those opportunities in those spaces this season. I think that there is plenty to like about it right now. Now, there are a few things to sort out. Like, is there a space for Nicholas Jackson in this side? Because I still think he's one of the better players that might actually work within this system. But he was left out of the squad in the win over Real Sociedad at the weekend. Like, can they get juice out of Romeo Lavia, for example, this season, who's just, you know, famously never available in so many different ways. But, you know, you've got someone like a Joro Hato who can play at left centre back as well. I think that there is a really nice, like, feel to much of this. I'm excited to see if Giovanni Kende will get minutes on that right back slot, but he's going to be battling against Marco Palestra, right? And we're going to see if Pep Javadia is going to nail down that left hand side, or whether they want an actual kind of more winger feel in there. Pedro Neto has been playing in that position at parts of the preseason as well. I just look at it and think, this is a really good side under a manager I rate incredibly highly. I think they're going to be much better. And if it does click in a way that I think it will, I don't think it's going to be necessarily plain sailing to begin with. I think we might see a fair bit of chaos in the early start of Chelsea's season, you know, 3-2s and 4-3s and kind of mad games in some regards. But once it does click and once this system starts to settle in, it's sort of a fluid three at the back that drops into a four at times out of possession. I think that if all of these things come to fruition in the way that I think Xabi Alonso is trying to make it work, it wouldn't stun me if Chelsea came second in the Premier League this year. It also wouldn't necessarily stun me if they came sixth. And I think that, you know, there's so many questions up in the air, and that's not necessarily a sitting on the fence answer, but I do genuinely believe that if this, you know, without European football, if Chelsea, you know, back Alonso to where he wants to be and they finalize a couple of these little squad bits that need sorting out before the end of the window, they might be end up being the team that actually has more of a consistent season than maybe some of their rivals who are also in these transition periods.
Yeah, I just hope they haven't got their act together by the time they play their first game of the season against Fulham on Monday. That's my main hope at this moment. And I won't look any further beyond that. I just hope they look a shambles when they turn up at Craven Cottage. That's a lot of stuff.
I agree heavily. I hope that Monday is not the time that Chelsea have pulled it all together. Let's all stick with that one for now. But I do think they're going to be a very good side this season. Much change at Spurs as well. Roberto De Zerbi, the third longest serving manager of the Big Six. It's all just incredibly chaotic in terms of the way things are changing, but they had a monster summer in some regards, Dean. There's still big question marks, I think, about the attack. And, you know, as much as Mikey Moore and Matias Tell have looked really, really good at parts of preseason, it's been kind of further back that they have done their big work thus far. They've clearly backed Roberto De Zerbi in the transfer market, and this feels like this could be the biggest kind of shift in positions from where Spurs were last year, you know, complete shambles for much of the actual campaign, to a team that looks like it might have a cohesive identity once again and genuinely try to get back to where they believe that they belong.
Yeah, I mean, Tottenham finished 17th in the league. They finished 2 points above West Ham, who just began their championship campaign this weekend. So Tottenham fans should be enjoying this moment and enjoying that they're going into another Premier League campaign and can breathe easy in the sense that this one is going to be different from the two Premier League campaigns that preceded it. It might not go all their way on the opening day. Brentford away, very difficult fixture for them to get up and running. But I think as they settle into the season, Tottenham will be good. De Zerbi came in and immediately set about making sure that his structure was in place. He got that defence sorted. He got the midfield changed. He hasn't yet got the attackers in that he wanted. He was promised he would have a new attacker in. Savinho has been on the doorstep for about 3 months now, waiting to walk through the door. His price tag's creeped up somehow from like 60 million to 87 million across that period of time. I've absolutely no idea how they've managed to do that, considering he wasn't playing very good football and hasn't played any football recently. So I don't know how his price tag is as high as it is. And very interested to see what it comes out in the wash at. But still talk around Cody Gakpo. Looked at signing Eli Junior Krupe. Considered trying to sign Endrick. You know, they've looked at all sorts of different solutions. They're trying to be really ambitious. But I think that certainly the changes in midfield with Matheus Fernandes and Sandro Tonali coming in gives the fan base and the club better structure, but also better quality. And Van der Ven obviously signing a new contract, moving on Romero, which needed to happen. And then bringing in Van Heek and Robertson. And it just seems to be quite stable to me. I don't think it's like amazing yet, but if you think that the aim is basically sixth, right? Like that's where you're aiming for, right? The step
incredible
up,
jump of 11
yeah,
places.
You're jumping 10 league places here, right? And it's definitely possible, but that's, you can't really aim much more than that right now. Maybe if the season starts to go well after 2-3 months, then you can start to change that. But for now, you just want to be back to where you recognize being, looking around you in the league positions, jostling for European positions and wondering which competition you're going to end up in the year after.
There's a couple of exciting youngsters as well that, you know, seem to be getting a little bit more excitement. Luca Williams-Barnett has been someone that they've talked about quite a lot. But, you know, when you look at the fact that they're in these situations and, you know, they're not going to have European football to contend with, it doesn't need to be a massive, massive squad in the same way that maybe some others have. Like, it just feels like Spurs are going into this season in a far more kind of settled state than they have been in a little while. And look, obviously things can spiral. They did last season, but from, you know, what I've seen and the way that it's played out, I think that there is plenty to be excited about in some regards. And look, Kinski, I think, will start the season as number one. But when you look at, you know, they brought in Fabianski to be an experienced backup, which feels like sensible maneuvers. Andy Robertson will add some leadership in there, as will Senesi. It just feels like they've brought in players that are going to hold others to account. We talk always about the, you know, the kind of relentlessness of the schedule and how things can spiral and did so for Spurs last year. You know, you need people in there being like, wait, you've got to take accountability for what's going on around you and take responsibility for the situations you find yourselves in. And right now, I feel like that's in a much better place at Spurs than it has been in quite some time.
Yeah, I think there's just a more trust involved in the whole process right now. I think that fans will be turning up at the stadium, finally not expecting to lose. I mean, that stadium has not been a fortress for some time. That needs to change. I think you're going to have leaders on the pitch finally to take some accountability, not look at each other, not to fear the worst every time you concede a goal, not to crumble, not to have the fans turning on you. It's a good shift. It feels like a good shift. It feels like De Zerbi has started to make changes before, and now they'll be set in stone as we get through this season.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll see how Spurs get on. I think we kind of look at it and say, you're talking about the big six. I want to include Aston Villa in this conversation. So the last team we'll get to before we break. Back in the Champions League after winning the Europa League last season. And I think that there is a decent argument that Aston Villa have the best manager in the Premier League in Unai Emery. And keeping him, continuing to build the squad around him. Yes, there's been some notable departures. Naturally, that one of Yuri Tielemans is going to sting, and Morgan Rodgers not being part of this squad anymore is obviously going to need filling as a gap. But actually, when you look at what Villa put together, they played that quite chaotic Super Cup against PSG where I didn't think they looked particularly overmatched. And even that was without Ollie Watkins, was without Ezri Konsa. We will see, obviously, if he remains an Aston Villa player. But I think that, you know, they've signed Zion Suzuki, it seems, in the past kind of 24 hours or so to come in and potentially be the number one. Yes, it's a move on from Emi Martinez, but it's still a young keeper with a really, really high ceiling. They've kept most of this squad together and they've added a few really interesting pieces like Brian Maggio, who's been there for a little while, but has really kind of emerged in this preseason. Same for George Hemmings. Yes, they're going to have to rely on a few more unknown names, but I think that Villa remain in a very, very good place. They remain in a wonderful spot with a brilliant manager. I would still be surprised if Villa aren't in the top six at the end of this season.
Yeah, and I totally take that point, and I don't see any reason why they won't be around there. I just think that they are going to have stronger competition to be in there. You know, they, everybody kind of got away with one a bit last year because you had Tottenham floundering, West Ham completely fell away, Newcastle were nowhere to be seen, Chelsea were mid-table. I just think we're getting a stronger version of the Premier League this season, if I'm totally honest. And I think that in line with that, Villa, from being fourth last season, are just nudged down the pecking order. I think they're going to have a lot on their plates this season. They'll still be a good team, but they can also be a flaky team. Let's never forget that. Like, Villa is a club slash a team that goes through spells of good and bad. And it's all about how they balance that across competitions this season. They're trying to grow as a club and obviously establish themselves in that top pack. But I do think it'll be much tougher because it's not just the traditional six that I say I'm expecting to kind of reassert themselves as the top six, but there's that group of clubs, you know, like Nottingham Forest, like they're just showing so much ambition. They'll be pushing people. You'll still have Brighton expecting to be in that conversation. Bournemouth will still expect to be. Sunderland probably fall away this season a little bit. I mean, that's just kind of part and parcel of second season syndrome and all the rest of it. Fulham may well improve. We don't know really yet what we'll get from them under Arbeloa. But I
could also get quite a lot worse, which is
There's all sorts of unknowns from that middle pack. You know, the bottom pack's going to probably be what it was in terms of the relegation teams. And I think that, obviously, yeah, the teams that came up last season and survived are still going to have work to do to prove that they are above and beyond being down there. But Aston Villa are very accomplished sides. Interesting that there's links at the moment with Ollie Watkins and Al Hilal. Certainly that's been something that's been explored. But yeah, this is a team that can't just keep standing still in terms of just being, oh, Ollie Watkins is a big part of what we'll do. If they feel like they have had the best of Ollie Watkins and could potentially move him on, it wouldn't surprise me to see Unai Emery being open to these sorts of things. Ezri Konsa would be pretty big miss if they did lose him. I was told that like Villa could do with one reasonably big sale this summer. It's not that they're in trouble financially, but like it would just settle things if they got a £60 million deal done, basically. So let's see what happens by deadline. But yeah, certainly Villa will be in and around that area.
I mean, look, I think the sales of Morgan Rodgers and Youri Tielemans have probably kind of calmed the waters in that regard. But yeah, if they want to go and reinvest heavily, you might need one more to just kind of flatten the bases before you go and spend money towards the end of the window. So yeah, plenty to consider. But I'm pretty confident that Villa will be there or thereabouts when it comes to the top six at the end of the year. I have absolute and unshakable faith in Unai Emery. And these players are still, as I read on a Villa website the other week, sipping on the Emery Kool-Aid, which I thought was a wonderful, wonderful descriptor. Right, we'll take a little break then. We come back on the other side. We'll rattle through everyone else in the Premier League. Stick with us. Welcome back to the third and final part of this Ranks FC episode. We've talked about the teams who are there at the top of the table, the biggest clubs in the Premier League, but there's plenty more excitement and also intrigue everywhere else. And I think, Dean, we'll start with the teams that finished in the European places last year. Bournemouth finished sixth. They then lost Andoni Iraola, replaced him with Marco Rosa. The big news out of the summer, really, that Eli Junior Kroupi got injured, which is going to potentially hold them back a little bit at the start of the season. It's still a relatively small squad, but I think the Rosa's a really good replacement for Iraola in terms of the way that he wants to play football and the way he will want to be on the front foot, the way his sides press, etc., etc. If he can kind of build the relationships that he has built at certain clubs in the past with this Bournemouth support, I think this could be a really, really fun ride. And actually, one of the things that's been interesting about Bournemouth over the course of this summer thus far was, yes, they lost Marcus Senesi, but then they replaced him with Antonio Silva from from Benfica, who's a really interesting player. He's never quite delivered yet on the potential that he had, but has been a captain, has been a leader, is someone that's been involved in Portugal squads going forwards as well. They lost like an Enes Unal and replaced him with Alvaro Rodriguez, who had a good season for Elche last year. And they brought in a right back in Juan Luis Sanchez, who I'd imagine is going to be more of a forward thinking option than what they've had to deal with in recent seasons. I think it's been a good summer, a summer that you kind of look at and think, okay, they've done their business in a kind of smart way. And I, whilst I don't necessarily expect them to finish sixth again, especially with the added competition playing in Europe as well, I think the Bournemouth could be a really interesting watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing actually for Marco Rosa, and that like Iraola basically took the club as high as they can go. Like, so he set the bar at a point which is going to be probably impossible to beat. And the good thing, I guess, is that there is a level of realization from everyone that, okay, well, that was great. It's kind of like when Fulham got to like Europa League final under Roy Hodgson. Like, we don't expect that again.
This is probably the top of what we're getting to.
Yeah. But obviously, like, you have hope that you could succeed in other ways. Bournemouth might be able to go far in a cup competition. They might still be competitive in the top 8 or 9 of the Premier League. It might well be, to be honest, that Bournemouth middle out here. They might end up mid-table. It wouldn't surprise me if that did start to happen. But one thing I do think that helps with their transition of managers is that it was all quite, it was fine.
Like, yeah, they had a 3-hour meeting.
Yeah, there was no animosity involved. They had a chat. They discussed nice restaurants in the area. They chatted about the player personalities. You know, it was a proper chinwag, right? And they've been able to swap notes and, yeah, pass it on to the next manager. Say good luck. And it wouldn't surprise me if he could even ring him up and he could advise him on what he should do in situations if he really wanted to. It seemed that amicable. Most clubs don't have that situation when they switch. There's obviously been a lot of change in the Premier League this summer and a lot of upheaval. I think Bournemouth is a little bit more settled. So there could have been a situation whereby if Bournemouth had got this wrong and not dealt with Iraola's exit well, then they were plunged towards the wrong end of the Premier League very quickly. I don't think that will happen. I don't think they'll equally stay like competing for like top six. But as I say, mid-table, fine this season for Bournemouth.
I think what's really interesting about them is, yeah, that stability. And actually, to move things on to Sunderland, is there a more stable club in the Premier League, maybe aside from Arsenal, than Sunderland, who have brought one player in thus far in the transfer window in Thomas Meunier, the experienced defender, Belgian from Lille. He'll replace Arthur Masuaku in that squad, effectively. They sold Eliezer Meyenda, who barely played last season. They sold Anthony Patterson, who was the third choice goalkeeper by the end of things. Like, it just feels like Sunderland have gone, okay, that worked. Let's just run it back. And they will stick, obviously, with Regis Debris. They will be playing in Europe, but it felt to me like the squad was probably big enough to deal with that. And I remember making this joke when they got promoted last year. Do they think they're building a European squad? Turns out the answer was yes. And they actually needed to do that. Obviously, it was a big outlay last summer. They're coming in a major profit thus far in this campaign. Just have no reason to believe that it's all going to go, you know, really particularly wrong for Sunderland. Holding on to Granit Xhaka was massive. And yes, they will probably suffer a little bit in terms of having more games and having to rotate, etc. So they'll probably drop down the table a little bit, but I'm not unduly worried about them either.
I don't know. Like, if I had to pick someone to kind of spiral, I might pick Sunderland just because so much does change season to season in the Premier League. I've already talked about how much stronger a lot of the teams have been getting, how they won't settle for the standards that have been there. So automatically, Sunderland do start getting nudged down. It'll be really interesting to see how they fare in their first three games because they've got Ipswich, Fulham and Brentford straight off the cuff before they then go into a game against Arsenal. And if those first few games have gone well, then we could be getting to game week 4 and being like, yeah, quite fancy an upset here. Sunderland are going to beat Arsenal. Equally, what if Ipswich pull off a scalp on that first day? It's not that big a scalp by Ipswich standards. Like, Ipswich won't have felt it unreasonable in recent years to have beat Sunderland. Like, so there's a possibility that these first three games are really important actually to Sunderland in terms of how this shakes out, just in terms of like setting themselves and making sure that they still feel they have that vibe of last year.
Stadium of Light is a fortress though, and it needs to remain.
It has been anyway, but like, yeah, it has been. Can change. Yeah.
It can change. I'm less worried about them than you. I think they'll be absolutely fine. There feels like a real brotherhood within this team that I think will continue through this season. So we shall see, but I'm not unduly worried about them. Let's go to Brighton, who will have expectations of winning the Conference League, especially given the fact that Crystal Palace won it last season. It's been a pretty busy summer for them. Jean-Paul Van Hecker heading off to Tottenham and effectively going the other way came Luka Vucevic, who is extremely talented, but relatively raw. I think that Van Hecker will be a big miss for Brighton because of the way that he punched the ball through the lines. And actually, if they're going to miss anyone who's kind of departed, that feels to me like a big one because of what he brought in terms of building out from the back. Obviously, they've also lost Danny Welbeck to Chelsea, and how they replace his goals it is going to be very, very interesting. They signed a couple of really intriguing players. Zaydok Yohana coming in from AIK and in Sweden, the Nigerian winger, who looks like he's going to be a whole lot of fun. But I'm not sure quite how much we'll see him in this season. You know, Brighton's propensity to sign a player and effectively you don't see them for a year and then suddenly they emerge as an absolute world beater. And I think there's quite a lot of eyes on him and Castagna and Svoboda, who's a defender that came in from Venezia, to kind of continue to show that the Brighton model works in some regards. Look, they've got a couple of really interesting players who might try to take up the mantle in terms of the goal scoring. Obviously, Ruter is a bit of a cult hero, but then there's Simas as well up top and Kostoulas as well. You know, are one of those going to step up now in the absence of Danny Welbeck to score the goals? That would be my only real concern with Brighton. I think that they will be absolutely fine, but they need the model to keep working. And I know that's an easy thing to say, but now playing European football again as well and with a real expectation to go and win that tournament, it's going to be interesting where the priorities lie for Fabian Hertzler, who, by the way, has just seemingly lost all of his hair over the course of one summer, and I have absolutely no idea what's going on.
Yeah, apparently it's not something he wants to particularly talk about as well. So, people will notice that. I know that there's been a few outlets working on that, and very, very strange. Anyway,
hope he's all right.
Completely unrelated to how Brighton are going to fare this season. I don't know, mate. I don't know what I expect from Brighton. What I am looking forward to, though, is that they play Chelsea in game week 2 in the Brighton v Chelsea derby. Chelsea, with aspirations to be the new Brighton, and might finally actually do that this season. I think Chelsea might convince me that they're better than Brighton this season. Danny Welbeck might be the final piece that they needed to become the new Brighton. I think it'll be a tough start for Brighton, and I think that they will be up against it. They may well be able to sort themselves out across the course of a season because they do tend to have a certain staying power, I think, and they manage to do that. But yeah, Villa, Chelsea, Leeds, I'm not that confident of how Brighton fare across those games.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll get a good indication of where Brighton are, you know, in those first couple, as you say. But, you know, it's the goals for me. If Kostoulas can kind of step up here, if Simas can step up here, then and I think that goes a long way to dealing with all of these situations. But, you know, just how they, you know, pick their priorities, I think could be very interesting for Brighton this season. To go and win a European competition would be absolutely incredible for the club as well. Let's go to Brentford, who have spent a lot of money, a club record deal on Mamadou Sangare of £39 million from Lens. They've also brought in Jadon Anthony, Yannick Schuster from RB Salzburg. That was like the first deal one of the whole window. And they brought in Callum Wilson as a little bit of backup firepower as well for Igor Thiago, who obviously had an incredible season last year. They have lost Jordan Henderson as the kind of only real first teamer that you're looking at and thinking, oh, that's something that they will miss his use of. But I think that Sangare is a brilliant, brilliant replacement. I think there's going to be a lot of Premier League clubs who are looking at him next summer and being like, why didn't we do that? That was a really good deal. He is an absolute ball-winning machine and a player that I really, really like. But I think that Brentford, you know, without European football here, with a summer of stability after last season's absolute chaos and change of manager and losing Mbeumo and losing Wisser, and everyone was like, oh, are Brentford going to get relegated? And then they were, you know, what, a point off the European places. This has been a summer of stability. Keith Andrews very much feet under the table now. I think Brentford might be the ones to emerge from this pack as actually the one to push on. And I think this could finally be the season that they do break through that European barrier.
Yeah, it could well be. It's so difficult. I'm glad we're not actually ranking the table today because I genuinely need to see like two game weeks to see how these teams all come out in the wash. Like, there's so many like similarities in terms of where I think their downfalls could be and where I think they could excel. But you're exactly right. Like, they're right in that pack.
Okay, I've got a feeling this could be Brentford's year. I really like this team.
I don't like to talk about it, mate. So that's kind of why I've skirted around the issue, as you've been.
They put seven past Eintracht Frankfurt the other day, and I was like, whoa, they look incredibly scary in attack.
Yeah, I think that was the least I've said of any club so far, and there's a reason for that.
No, I think this is a very good Brentford team, and I think that they will come away a little bit more from their kind of reliance on set pieces. That last year, I don't think any club created more opportunities from set pieces, more of their opportunities from set pieces than Brentford. I think they'll be a little bit more well-rounded this season. I think that Keith Andrews is developing as a coach, and yeah, I think they're going to be it's a little bit scarily good in some regards. So, yes, we will see. Let's go over to our beloved Fulham quickly. If you are very interested in Fulham, then you can listen to me talk about this in real depth later in the week on the Fulhamish podcast. But another summer
10 years of Fulhamish, mate. 10 years you've been going.
10 years. Oh, it all started there.
Unbelievable. I didn't know podcasts have been going for 10 years.
Well, there you have it. There's been a few that are longer going than us.
It's been 12.
Yeah, I was a young man when I started that, and now I have, you know, I'm Fabian Hertzlering it at the moment in terms of what that all looks like. A summer of change here as well, DJ. Alvaro Arbeloa replacing Marco Silva after 5 years of real stability, and a couple of big exits as well. Harry Wilson and Raul Jimenez, who were Fulham's top two scorers and probably two best players last season. Sasha Lukic and Issa Diop, who were very reliable squad options, both going over to Ipswich Town, and instead it's now Real Madrid B, because Gonzalo Garcia joined for a big, big fee, as did Cesar Palacios, who a lot of people are very excited about. And Fulham also signed Shay Charles from Southampton. I'd love to preview this, and I've said this all along, no idea what it's going to look like. Fulham have looked pretty good for some of pre-season. There have been some real signs of life. I think this is a little bit of a lightweight squad, but I'm also expecting Fulham to be a bit more front-footed this season. Got a striker who likes to shoot in Garcia, which is a change up for the books. The first time that Fulham have had a player like that since Alexander Mitrovic was at the club. But I also have a quite nasty feeling that if this starts badly, it could get quite ugly quite quick.
I am actually quite excited, to be honest, because Fulham needed change. It had become stale. It had become predictable. I would put a game on and know what I was getting. And if I knew that, then all the other teams knew what they were getting too. Don't get me wrong. It still sometimes worked because Marco Silva was magic and he had this team playing some tried and tested football that would be brilliant at times. But equally, the flaws were the flaws and the system had run its course as far as I was concerned. And I think Marco, it needed a new voice. I think a lot of these players needed a new voice, and also it needed a bit of a refresh. I don't think there's been enough of a refresh at this point, but Fulham do have a tendency to leave things late, so I'll have to reserve judgment until the very final day of the window. I think Palacios looks awesome. I like Gonzalo Garcia. I think Sander Berger looks great. Slight concern if Berger was to get injured that we're left short a little bit in that spot, because it seems like he's carrying a lot of weight in this team, judging by what we've seen so far. But Arbeloa has a lot to prove. And I think that that's a good thing for us, that he's got a lot on the line here. You know, Real Madrid rate him so highly that, like, I know that they've got half a mind that one day he will be manager for them again. Like, that what they haven't ruled out one day him returning, because they do believe he's got something about him. This is a big job for him. It's a big step in a different direction. And he'll definitely have some testing times. This first game of the season, it's not a bad time to play Chelsea, because it's a bit of a gimme. Like, as long as he doesn't get hammered here.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know, like, and I don't think they will. I famous last words and all that, but like, I don't think Fulham will get hammered in this game. Might lose it by all means. Of course, that could happen. But watching that Stuttgart game at Craven Cottage the other day, Arbeloa's first game there, it did give me some confidence. I like the intensity with which they played, the quicker pressing. I do like it, mate. I think that at the very least, we've got a very good starting lineup and couple of subs. Depth-wise, we might not be there. Like, I don't think we're challenging for much at that top end this season. But I do think we might get a new Fulham that we start to enjoy.
I think given all the change, finishing 14th is probably fine. And it wouldn't be a step forward, but as long as some of the new boys have a good season, I would see that as a relative success, given the amount of upheaval and turmoil at the club after, you know, a period of, exactly as you said, knowing what we were getting. So we will see. All right, quickly, let's go to Newcastle United, who've had maybe the most upheaval of anyone this summer. Eddie Howe leaving the club, him being replaced by Matthias Jeister. They've lost Sandro Tonali, they've lost Bruno Guimaraes, they've lost Anthony Gordon for very, very big fees. They've sold very well, Newcastle. In came Bazemana Touré from Hoffenheim, which I'm really excited about. Alhaji Bamba and Lucas Hornacek as a new first-choice goalkeeper. Sean Sturt as well, who looks like a bit of a stud and I'm very excited about. But this is all change, all hands to the pump at Newcastle, and it does feel a little bit like a completely new era at the club.
Yeah, I'm a bit worried for them, to be honest. It was obviously fizzling out under Eddie Howe. I was surprised he even got to the summer, to be honest with you. It felt like they needed a change. I don't know. I've heard a lot about this coach, people talking about him in a very high regard. From a personal perspective, I don't have any basis on which to judge him yet, so I'm not going to. But this isn't really even about his actual coaching capability per se. It's like the whole vibe of Newcastle United and how it's fallen away. Their team has fallen apart. They were they came in with these big ambitions, new ownership. They built a good team under Eddie Howe, playing Champions League football, and obviously losing big names, losing the manager. I don't know. I think it's going to be tough. And I don't have much pressure on him to achieve anything this season. I guess that's one positive for him. But I think the bigger task is making sure that things don't go through the floor. You know, let's not worry about how high the ceiling is. Let's just worry that Newcastle don't go through the floor, because like I've suggested, I think that Sunderland could go tumbling. It wouldn't take a lot for their northeast rivals, Newcastle, to be in a similar boat, to be honest.
I think it's going to be very interesting, you know, what Jeister does with Nick Voltermada, who, you know, looks like he's going to be staying at the club. Does he build an attack around him? Does he utilize him in a front two? Does he play him as a number 10? Like, there's loads and loads of questions about Voltermada, and I think that it's quite intriguing. He's a bit of a unicorn player, and as much as I really like him, I do think you need to work out a system that plays to his strengths without, you know, ignoring anyone else. And, you know, now that this is an opportunity for other players to step up, and you know, I always felt that Newcastle should probably have signed more players in the mold of Bruno Guimaraes when they signed him, because he was, you know, a very, very talented footballer, but hadn't quite broken through at the top level yet when he was at Lyon. And I think there was an excitement around him, but no one was quite like, oh, are we going to drop the money needed to sign him? But he obviously went through the ceiling in his time at Newcastle. It looks like they're going back to a model more like that. Sean Sturr is really exciting. Bazemana Touré is really exciting. Alhaji Bamba is really exciting. But you're putting a lot of faith in those players to hit the ground running. And, you know, there's now a lot of pressure on someone like a Lewis Miley to have a really good season there. And he's looked very good in preseason, as is his brother, 17 years old, by the way, Mason, at right back, which is going to be interesting. They do look a little bit light, but I think that it could be a very interesting season for Newcastle. I'd imagine that Jeister, who is a manager that I respect quite highly, and I really liked his work with Salzburg before he went over to Saudi Arabia, where I've seen far less of him, admittedly. But the way that he played football felt like it would be something that the Newcastle fans could get behind, you know, a brand of football that they might well be able to enjoy. And I think that that for me is a good sign. If the expectations are lowered and it's a question of, can you get this team to, I don't know, be in the European conversation by March? And even if you finish sort of 9th or 10th, is there a step forward that you can make to show that these players are in a first season, have far more to come in terms of trajectory? And that for me, I think, is the exciting bit that they have going for them. So I am quite excited to see what this team looks like under Yaissa for Newcastle United. All right, Dino, let's go over to Everton. It's been a relatively quiet summer. They brought in two of the loanees from last year in Tariq George and Merlin Roll. They signed Hayden Hackney from Middlesbrough, which I think is a really good signing. I'm a big, big fan of Hayden Hackney. Christian Norgaard for $7 million felt like a very smart little bit of business to basically fill the Idrissa Gana Gueye size gap in that midfield. And then they were the first team we'll talk about in this mad swap deal. They've got Brennan Johnson in from Palace in return for Dwight McNeil, who was barely playing football for Everton anyway. So it feels like a good bit of summer in terms of a good bit of business in terms of the summer. It doesn't feel like loads has changed. And obviously, Jack Grealish at the moment doesn't look like he's going back to Everton. There isn't loads of excitement, you know, for having spoken to people around the club that this is going to be a season to remember. But also, I don't necessarily worry for them too much either. I think David Moyes is too wily an old fox to have them anywhere near the relegation battle.
Mate, they just need something to happen, this fan base. I mean, it's been such a dull 5 years, hasn't it?
Like, they're quite bored, I think.
They're like, nothing's happening. Like, their league position, like, okay, they're not in danger at the bottom. And that's a bit of an improvement from a few years ago when they look like they might go down. But, like, they're just, like, flirting beneath mid-table. Like, nobody has any desire to do that in any league in the world football. Like, it's fine if you're like the promoted team and like that's your first season or your second season. Like, Sunderland might settle for that this season. But Everton should just have more about them than this. Look, it's been a pretty sensible summer, to be honest, is the best way to sum up what they've done. They've made good business decisions. They're building a squad that is suited to what David Moyes build wherever he goes, and they've probably got one or two new names to come in, a striker.
They need a right back because Jamie Coleman has finally been released. I think he's going to join the coaching staff there at this point. But also, you know, Jake O'Brien is not a right back and has been played out of position there for so long now that it feels like, please go and sign the right back that's going to fill that gap.
Yeah, they just feel like a team that. As I say, they will sign a couple of players before deadline. They just like, they are what they are. And if things are going bad in a game, then they'll lose. And if they're playing well, then they'll win. They don't really make change. They, and up to now anyway, they haven't really like had the ability to have big game changes, have big game swings. I never feel like that with Everton. I feel like what you see is what you get. Quite often the 11's the 11. And they got one or two that come in and out of it. For now, they've got Ndiaye. I think that that's obviously big. He's a fantastic player. Been a lot of interest in around teams trying to sign him this summer. If they can hold on to him, then it'll be big. But yeah, for the sake of Everton fans, and you know, this is a big football club and they've got a really nice new stadium. I really hope that they can do something in some competition across the next 10 months.
Well, we will see. We will see. But it does feel like the Everton fan base just would like something to happen, I think, at this point. And, you know, I can understand that as well. Last year, it felt like consolidating the new ground and, you know, make sure it's somewhere that is a good place for them to go. Like being relegated, you know, would have been an absolute nightmare. The season before as well, where they were much closer to that, you know, opening that new stadium in the Championship would have been absolute death knell in some regards. So they've consolidated now. They feel much safer as a club, but equally safe is sometimes a little bit dull as well. So I completely agree. Leicester at Leeds United, though, who have signed James Trafford for a massive fee from Manchester City, also shelled out for Tarek Muharemovic, who I genuinely thought was going to go to Inter or back to Juventus. So that was a big coup for Leeds as well. And then bringing in Harry Wilson from Fulham on a free. Effectively, Wilson replaces Jack Harrison, who didn't play very much last season either. And Muharemovic replaces Pascal Strike. And James Trafford replaces Carl Darlow. Leeds were absolutely fine by the end of last season. They'd kind of got past the pit where they were a little bit worried and looking over their shoulders. And that feels like three massive improvements for me. I think that their trajectory is upwards.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be very far upwards. I mean, what did they finish? 14th last season, I think. I imagine they'll finish maybe 11th this season at best. I've seen people saying, oh, these signings, they can start pushing for Europe and stuff. Like I've said in this podcast, like everybody's saying that, and like depends what your starting base is and like what your improvements are. The main thing for Leeds United is to establish yourself as a Premier League club again. That is what they've got to do. They haven't got, like, it wouldn't be a good thing to suddenly have conference football next season. They don't need to be playing European football of that level because it will derail what they're trying to do on a domestic level. Leeds need to slowly build to get back to what they want to be, which is a side that belongs in the Premier League. They'll be looking at teams like ours, at Fulham, and thinking like, how are a small club like that doing it when we are a much bigger club and we are incapable of it? We are just like constantly yo-yoing. And not even that at times. Suddenly they're stuck in the Championship. So I think that Leeds, look, the match-going fans that have been through thick and thin for the last 30 years or whatever will just be like, can we just like have a solid season again? That was great. That'll do for now. So yeah, I reckon Leeds finish somewhere between like 11th and 13th.
Yeah, I mean, look, upward trajectory would be a good thing. I'm completely with you. I think there's a couple of statement signings there. I think Muharemovic and Trafford are statement bits of business. And, you know, we can kind of look at those and be like, they're big fees. And Leeds have clearly kind of got one eye on it. But you think about the kind of player they're bringing in. And Wilson's a little bit of an exception. I'd imagine he's going to play in the tens behind the striker. They've kept hold of the big guns. I'd imagine there would have been, you know, it's been a big summer for midfielders. There would have been coveter's eyes at Anton Stack, right, after what he put together last season. Leeds have established what they want to be here, which is a team that's incredibly hard to beat. They need to get better at scoring goals at one end of the field. And, you know, they're already pretty good from a defensive perspective. I'd imagine they're going to get better with Trafford and Muharemovic in there. But also, they probably do need a couple more attacking pieces to just add to their capabilities in that final third. And if they can do that, there is no reason. I also think, and to your point there about, you know, finishing sort of 11th, 13th, I think we might be on for another season where it's like proper concertinaed between 8th and 15th. And if that's the case, and if you're in that pack, that's an okay place to be, right? Like, as long as you're in there, it means that, you know, if you're 5 points off the European places in March, a couple of good results and you're suddenly into that picture. That would be a place to, you know, obviously set pulse is a place, sure. But also, I think you're absolutely right in terms of maintaining a positive trajectory is perhaps the most important thing for Leeds at this point. And I think they're well placed to do so. Let's go to Crystal Palace, who obviously will also be playing European football. I did it in terms of where the league table played out. So they're a little bit lower down this than perhaps they should be. A couple of really interesting pieces of business. Now, obviously, they lost Maxence Lacroix to Chelsea, which feels like a bit of a blow considering how important he was to that team. But Jadon Kamara has looked really, really good. Jadon Kamara has looked really, really good in pre-season. And then you kind of look at it and think, okay, they've brought in some backup at right wing back in Anil Khelaili. They look like they're about to complete that deal for Xavier Gozo, which is a really exciting one. I think he's going to play a bit further forward. He's been playing as a wing back for RSL, but I think he might be kind of someone that they see as potentially being in that kind of Ismail Assar mold, considering like his height and the way that he runs. And, you know, having spoken to people this week about him in MLS circles, they're very excited about his physical capabilities and what he can bring to the Premier League in that regard. Again, they signed Tomiyasu on a free from Arsenal. They signed Mingueza. It looks like Pierre Sarge is going to stick with the three at the back formation. Dwight McNeil comes in. I'd imagine he's going to play as a wing back. And then they re-signed Evan Gesson. They needed to bulk the squad out, right? It felt too light for European football last season. So far, so good in terms of bulking it out a little bit, Dim.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they've obviously taken a bit of a gamble on the manager. I know he's done well in France, but untested now and going up against some real, real pedigree in terms of what you're seeing in the other dugouts. There's not a lot of settling in time here with a team that does need to start pretty well. Going to Everton, first game of the season, you know, two sides that
you know,
the Dwight McNeil Brennan Johnson derby, you say?
That's pretty crazy, isn't it? That's quite funny because that's quite a big storyline. A rare swap deal transfer, and they're going to play each other. I just wonder if they're going to get confused. Like, is Dwight McNeil, you know, his first game for his new club? Is it Everton? It's nothing different for him. But yeah, I'm not sold on what they're trying to do. I know they were in a difficult situation trying to move on from Glasner, but I have them in kind of gamble territory, mate, and hopefully they fare better than I'm predicting for the likes of Sunderland and Newcastle. But it wouldn't surprise me if they ended up having a bit of a tricky patch.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's a level of risk associated with all of this, but I think Pierre Sage is a good manager, and I'm kind of interested as to how he puts all of this together. Look, someone is going to get dragged in, right? Like, and it could, as we said before, that it wouldn't surprise me hugely if it was Fulham. It would surprise me a little bit more if it was Palace, but it depends how kind of heavily they lean into their European commitments. As you said, you know, Sunderland, Newcastle, a little bit unknowns. I'm hotter on Sunderland than you are, but Newcastle remains the big question mark in that regard. So, you know, it can happen to anyone in some ways. But I think it would take something going pretty spectacularly wrong for Palace to be dragged in there. And look, that can happen. But I think that their signings have been pretty smart. And the fact that they needed to make this squad bigger, it seems to be working so far, I think, in terms of what they've got. But, you know, replacing Glasner is no easy task, which takes us along to his new club, which I imagine has gone down really well with Crystal Palace fans. He's gone to Nottingham Forest. You spoke about them briefly earlier on in the podcast, talking about their ambition. Now, they've lost Elliot Anderson, who was an absolutely huge player for them. And there's no getting away from exactly how important he's been for Nottingham Forest. That move to City has obviously brought them a lot of money. They've gone and signed Usman Diamande. Xavi Schlager, I think, is a really interesting replacement coming in on a free from Leipzig. 28 years old. That feels like an absolute steal. I really like Xavi Schlager. And, you know, Austrian international, plenty of experience, should fit what Glasner's trying to do in that midfield pairing. But you look at the back line, now that Diamande has gone in, a back three of Diamande, Murillo and Milenkovic. Good luck getting through that. And from there, you know, if Forest win 1-0, no one's going to be complaining about that. I think that they might be on for one of the teams to have the biggest rise this season.
Yeah, I mean, I saw them described as a team that were in a permanent state of emergency last season. And it kind of felt real, didn't it? They tumbled down the league from the year before. They ended in 16th. They were putting out fires all over the place, on and off the pitch. It's always a bit chaotic. But one thing you can't knock Forest for is their ambition. And obviously the direction they've gone in backs that. Some really good signings, a backroom staff that can be trusted, organised. I actually think Forest will have a good season. I know there's a few teams here that I've poured cold water over, but Forest are not going to be one of them. I think they'll finish in the top half.
Yeah, I do too. I think that they will improve massively under Glasner. Obviously, a manager getting a pre-season is a good thing. But the managerial swings last season from the way that they were trying to play football made absolutely no sense whatsoever. And, you know, it's felt like this time round, at the very least, they look like they have a plan, which is usually a good sign for the start of a season. So I think Forest are going to be just fine, even if they do miss Elliot Anderson in the middle. Which takes us onto the promoted sides, Dean. And, you know, obviously, deals can be done between here and the end of the window, but it looks like a big ask for the promoted sides to pull things together. We'll go through them in terms of order. Currently, I think Ipswich are probably the sides that I think have done the best business in terms of reinventing themselves. But we'll start with Coventry City, because they've made a couple of splashes in recent days. Caleb Jurenki came in, the Ghanaian midfielder, who's people are very, very excited about. There's a lot of talk about him becoming the second coming of Michael Essien. But him, you know, working under Frank Lampard could make that very, very interesting. But 20 years old and a really exciting footballer. They finally signed Carl Rushworth, who had been on loan there from Brighton as their number one. some of the other signings feel a bit risky. Lum Chona, who came in from Burnley, is very mercurial. Amenda from Eintracht Frankfurt is a good player, and I like him, but feels very raw at this point in his career. Awani is a good player, brought in from Forest for a good fee at £9 million, but has spent a lot of time injured. Maybe their best bit of business is bringing back Gus Hamer, who will be very, very popular after returning to the club. He was there for 3 years, I think, up to about 2023, 2024. And then he went off to Sheffield United, but has come back to the club now. It does just feel a little bit lightweight as a squad for me, and that would be my worry with Coventry.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a team that's been missing from the Premier League for 25 years. It's good to have them back. Like, it feels like the beginning of the Premier League era, really, having Coventry back in there. They are a big team, and it's going to be a big test for them to show that they can hang around. I mean, this is a team that completely fell away. So they've done well, to be honest, as a club, to even rebuild and get back to where they are. Obviously, the romance is angled towards Frank Lampard, who took over and kind of stabilised the club.
He did a wonderful job, like an absolutely wonderful job. And I've been critical of Frank Lampard as a manager in the past. And look, I stand by those criticisms. But since he went back in at Coventry, I think he's done a brilliant job.
Yeah, one of the things he did there was, you know, he was tactically flexible. He started with one setup when he first went in, and then he kind of evolved and adapted his game. And to be fair to Frank Lampard, I've certainly been somebody that's had concerns about his management styles and all this stuff, but he does keep learning. He does keep changing. And when he makes mistakes, he uses them to his benefit as he moves forward. And obviously, he's still young in management terms. So I think he could yet have a decent career in management. But he knows what he wants from his team. He will already know the 11 that he wants on most weeks and how those players are going to be swapped in and out when they need to be. They went on a remarkable run of not naming a changed team. It was 23 games without naming any changes to his lineup for Frank Lampard at Coventry. So he knows what he wants and he goes with it. Let's see whether he can get away with that so much in the Premier League, which is obviously much more demanding. You're not going to get
less games, though.
There's less games, but obviously the intensity of those games and the
especially when you don't have 60% of the ball, I assume.
Yeah, you're up against the ball. You've got everything going against you and the opposition much more capable to evolve tactically within the duration of a 90 minutes and bring game changes on of their own. It's going to be really, really difficult, obviously, for Coventry. They've had quite a lot of focus on a higher defensive line, which will be interesting to see how that plays out and whether he continues with that. But yeah, obviously you presume that they go down because that's what you do with any promoted team that doesn't have obvious capability of staying up, but we'll see.
I mean, look, I think they're trying to adapt and evolve what they had last season rather than completely turn it over, which has not been a particularly successful venture in recent times, which I think is interesting. And it's why I think maybe Ipswich, for me, have the best chance of survival of the three of them, because effectively they've gone down the Leeds and Sunderland route of effectively buying an entire new team. And I think that they've done so quite successfully for the most part. Now, there are question marks about the goals. They signed Emerson from Toulouse, the young Brazilian, who is looking like he's going to be expected to shoulder that goal scoring burden. And I'm not 100% sure that that's going to give them enough goals. But what they have done is they've brought in Julio Enciso, who's obviously an excellent creative forward. We saw a bit of that at the World Cup. And Dyson Maeda, who might well be the best pressing forward in the world. And I think the Ipswich Town fans are going to absolutely love Dyson Maeda. Now, his first touch is a bit ropey, but his second touch is beautiful. And he does not give defenders a moment's peace. I'd imagine they'd probably deploy him off the left, where he can just effectively hassle and harry. And I think that that's a useful thing to have. And then you go into the midfield, they've signed Florentino Luis from Burnley, who didn't have the best of times there last year, but I think is a more than capable Premier League midfielder. They signed Sasha Lukic from Fulham, which feels like good experience. And it looks like they're on the verge of signing Ezequiel Palacios from Bayer Leverkusen as well, the Argentine international. That would be a very difficult midfield to break down. And I think that probably puts them in good stead. They brought in Issa Diop as well, who I think is a more than capable Premier League defender. There's a couple of other players in terms of who they brought in. Kjell Skjerpen, the goalkeeper who was in the Premier League with Brighton, although he didn't play very much. It just feels like they've gone down that complete renewal route, Dean. And actually, I think it might be the best way of trying to ensure survival. They look like they're going to be a physically competent unit. And that is somehow, sometimes half the battle.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, while you want to be loyal to the players that got you to this situation, it doesn't work. So, like, as a football club, you have to be ruthless and you have to move forwards. And I mean, they spent like £200 million or something, haven't they? Like, it's been pretty wild. But that's what it takes. You've got to spend.
Well, last time they effectively just didn't spend enough money and they didn't kind of shore up the middle. Ipswich was so easy to play through the last time they were in the Premier League. I think they've at least seen that and be like, that's not happening again, which is, you know, good learnings.
Yeah, you'd think. So that'll be interesting. But yeah, as you say, like their business in the transfer window, I think it's 13 signings now, I think.
I think Palacios will be 14 when
14,
he comes in.
Yeah, I mean, that's a proper overhaul of a squad. But Sunderland made a similar amount, like you said. So last summer when they came up, I didn't think that would work. It did. They started to get in players of the pedigree needed. And that's actually turns out often to be more important than the togetherness, the bond of the championship winning team. You know, there's only so far brotherhood can get you. Sometimes you just need quality players and it looks like Ipswich are trying to find them.
Yeah, and it's quite a nice mix, I think, of Premier League proven and a couple of players who are coming in with kind of like very, very high level experience as well, which is exciting, I think, for Ipswich fans. And takes us to Hull City, the final team in this episode, who obviously won the playoffs, were part of that chaotic campaign where Southampton were thrown out and then suddenly it was Borough who'd lost and got back in, and Hull took advantage, Ollie McBurney, in the Championship playoff final to get them here. I think they're about as kind of stunned as anyone else that they found themselves in this position. It doesn't look like there's quite enough here yet, and I am a little bit concerned about their goal scoring threat. Like, they've signed Joe Gelhart, who was there on loan last season up front from Leeds, but I'm not 100% sure he's going to score the goals that they need. But they've brought some really interesting players. Zalakis from Olympiakos, one of the kind of most exciting young goalkeepers around, brilliant with his feet and a really good shot stopper as well. And then Jens Hjerto Dahl, who I think might be one of the most interesting signings in the entirety of the Premier League. A Norwegian defensive midfielder signed from Tromso, who looks like he glides around the pitch. There's been comparisons to Sander Berger back in his homeland, which you would expect considering his kind of physical profile, but he's a much better passer of the ball. And someone that I think genuinely at £10 million is an absolute snip. I'm really, really excited to see what he can do from a Premier League perspective. And if they are going to have a puncher's chance of survival, I think he's going to be absolutely crucial. They also signed Lucas Herrington, the Australian defender who played at the World Cup, 18 years old from the Colorado Rapids. He's, I think, just overtaken He's just overtaken Suter as the most expensive Australian player ever, if I'm not mistaken, which is a big gamble. He's been brilliant for the Rapids, but it feels like a lot of gambles here. And I think that's maybe the difference between them and Ipswich. If they pay off, this could be super successful, but it's much more of a risk, I think, than what Ipswich are doing.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is overachieving at its finest. Like, Hull City, based on expected points, would have been relegated from the Championship last season. They pulled out results that were completely unexpected and basically ended up with about 20 more points than would have been predicted by stats models. So, they've overcome that likelihood, obviously ended up getting into the playoff final against all odds too, and now find themselves in the Premier League. And I think that there'll be a certain sense of bewilderment about them, to be honest, when they line up on the opening day of this season, looking around each other, thinking, oh my God, we're playing Man United today. How are we doing this? Like, how's this happened? But it has. And certainly on the opening day of the season, they haven't really got much to lose. Like, you're playing Man United, a team that we've seen can be irritated quite easily and quite easily beaten against the odds, I guess. But this is an opportunity for them to lay down a marker in game week one. It's two very different challenges. Like, Man United at home, game week one, and then Coventry away, game week two. It's a really good way, I think, for Hull to begin their season. Like, the fans can have a celebration of being back in the Premier League and having such a big fixture, and then get back to the realities of just getting to Coventry and trying to get out with some points.
Yeah, I mean, I do enjoy that Hull have gone and signed four defensive midfielders this summer, which maybe tells you a little bit about how they're going to approach this. Yeah, so Dahl being the kind of high profile one, but they also signed Luka Gurnadwath, who I think is a really interesting player from Salzburg. And then Hidemasa Morita, who very experienced, one of the key players in the Amorim sporting system as well. They picked him up on a free, and they made Oscar Zambrano's loan into a permanent deal. So it might tell you a little bit about how Hull are going to go about their business. It feels like they need more in the market, especially goals at the sharp end. As much as Ollie McBurnie is a wind-up merchant and a great person to have on your side, the kind of person you hate playing against, but I think that they probably need a little bit more goal-scoring threat if they're gonna punch above their weight. But I do think some of these players are really interesting as well, so I'm excited to see what it looks like. And with that, DJ, we have come to the end of our Premier League preview, all 20 teams covered to some extent. And I feel like we've done a very good job there, then, if I'm honest.
Yeah, we've done it, mate. We got there. So it all begins on Friday. Arsenal against Coventry City. Then Hull v Man United, the early game on Saturday. We've got a few games on Sunday with Man City and Liverpool in action. And then it all comes to a close on Monday, is when game week one really is shaped up as Fulham take on Chelsea. There's loads to get stuck into, mate. And I hope I can watch quite a lot of those games, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, we'll be across it all the way on Ranks FC. A reminder that if you've got this far and you fancy joining us over on our Patreon, we'll be looking back at all the weekend's games on our post box, all the ones that are asked about. We'll get across all of that. Chat to us, shape the conversation. We would absolutely love to have you over there. The link, as ever, is in the description. It's a great time to join ahead of a new season. We'll be covering all of the big European leagues, the big stories in football, and of course all the Premier League as well. And with that, DJ, I think it is time for us to go. So all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been the big Premier League preview here on Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever, and we'll see you all very, very shortly. Take it easy. Peace.